June 12, 1993, Santa Clara, California. 21-year-old U.S. Army Private Justin Bergwinkle leaves his girlfriend's apartment and never returns. 1 week earlier, Justin had gone AWOL from Fort Lewis, the post where he was stationed in Washington, and kept hinting to his girlfriend that he was working on some sort of secret mission. 3 months later, Justin's abandoned car is found at a motel in Monterey, with his military dog tags and most of his personal items inside. And while the Army denies that Justin was ever involved in any secret operation, no trace of him is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week we're going to be exploring a bizarre mystery involving a missing soldier from the United States Army, the 1993 disappearance of Justin Bergwinkle. This case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and not surprisingly, I've received numerous requests to cover this one since the inception of this podcast. During the mid-1990s, Unsolved Mysteries went through a period where they produced a lot of segments involving potential conspiracies within the military. They would usually focus on an American serviceman who was found dead under suspicious circumstances, but even though their deaths were officially ruled to be suicides, their loved ones were certain that they were murdered, and the military was covering something up. However, the Justin Bergwinkle case stands out from the others because he was never confirmed to be dead. Instead, he went absent without leave from his base in Washington State and traveled to California before he vanished without a trace, and he has not been seen in nearly 30 years. Prior to his disappearance, Justin had been displaying paranoid and erratic behavior and implied that he was working on some sort of secret mission, though the military has always denied this. The two potential explanations seem to be that Justin either got himself in way over his head with something and became the victim of foul play, or he suffered some sort of mental breakdown, and this so-called mission was nothing more than a fantasy he had concocted in his own mind. But if that's the case, then what actually happened to Justin? Surprisingly, this is not a story which has gotten a lot of coverage in the media, as the only sources you'll find online are the Unsolved Mysteries segment and an article that was published in the Sacramento Bee newspaper in November of 1993. In fact, it's not even clear to me if there's still an active official investigation to find Justin. It's also worth noting that prior to his transfer to Washington, Justin was stationed at California's Fort Ord, and Unsolved Mysteries once produced another segment about a soldier named Paul Whipke, who vanished from Fort Ord under mysterious circumstances back in 1958. I covered Whipke's disappearance 3 years ago when the trail went cold, so on this episode, I'm going to spend some time comparing these two cases. But before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved disappearance of Justin Bergwinkle. Our story begins in 1993, and our central figure is 21-year-old Justin Bergwinkle. Justin was originally born in Clinton, Massachusetts to his parents, Walter and Diane Bergwinkle, and he has two brothers. After being an honor student throughout high school, Justin enlisted in the U.S. Army following graduation and initially set his sights on being a paratrooper. Following his completion of boot camp during the summer of 1990, Justin, who had been an excellent foreign language student in high school, earned a spot at the Defense Language Institute, located at the Presidio of Monterey in California. While there, he specialized in Korean language training and reportedly told his family that he was eventually hoping to serve with the elite combat unit, the Army Rangers. However, Justin's military career hit a major snag in early 1991 after a shoplifting incident where he and some of his friends were caught stealing some tapes from a video store. As punishment, Justin was drummed out of the Defense Language Institute and sent to Cook School in South Carolina. He was subsequently sent back to California and reassigned to Fort Ord, located just outside Monterey, where he became a culinary specialist who prepared meals for his fellow soldiers. Justin was left pretty discouraged by the situation and was unable to rise above the rank of private, but things started to look up for him in August of 1992 when he became romantically involved with a woman named Yolanda Antunes. Yolanda was a computer science student at Santa Clara University who lived in an apartment in the city, and even though Santa Clara was located 85 miles away from Fort Ord, Justin took frequent trips back and forth in order to visit Yolanda. Even though they had a strong relationship, Yolanda did notice some odd behavior from Justin, who would sometimes abruptly end their dates or cut off his visits by saying that he needed to go back to Monterey. During our Unsolved Mysteries interview, Yolanda stated, quote, "All of a sudden, he would just stop what he's doing with me in the afternoon, and he would just say, 'I'm sorry, but I have to go to Monterey and see some people, but I'll be right back,'" end quote. Justin would attempt to explain his behavior by telling Yolanda that he was involved in something secret and he couldn't tell her about it. Things became more complicated in February of 1993, when Justin was transferred from Fort Ord to Fort Lewis, which was located in Washington State over 800 miles north from Santa Clara. But in spite of this, Justin continued to maintain his relationship with Yolanda and would travel back to California to visit her whenever he could. In May of that year, Justin was granted a two-week furlough from Fort Lewis and went to stay at Yolanda's apartment, but she noticed that his behavior was becoming even stranger. Justin brought along a briefcase on the trip, which he was very secretive about, and he would never open it in front of anyone. If he did open it inside Yolanda's apartment, Justin would ask her to turn her head and not look, but there was one moment when she managed to catch a glimpse of Justin over her shoulder and saw him pulling small pieces of paper out of the briefcase, which he tore apart with his hands. There was also another incident where Yolanda found Justin sobbing alone inside her living room, but he refused to say what was bothering him and said there was nothing wrong. The strangest event which occurred during Justin's visit was when Yolanda received a phone call at her apartment from an unidentified man who asked for Justin. When Yolanda told the caller that Justin was out with friends, he asked her to let him know that, quote-unquote, "the mission's off." Even though Yolanda asked for clarification about what the caller meant, he simply responded, quote, "just tell him, the mission's off." When Justin returned to the apartment later that night, Yolanda believed that he looked very pale, and she told him what the caller said. This caused Justin to become enraged, and he started storming through the apartment, but when Yolanda asked what was going on, he replied, quote, "you don't want to know." After Justin's furlough ended, he returned to Fort Lewis and phoned his parents in Clinton, and they did not notice anything unusual about him. But around the same time period, credit card records would show that Justin purchased two handguns, a .357 revolver, and a 9mm semi-automatic, as well as over 100 rounds of ammunition and some gun cleaning equipment. At 4:30 a.m. on Friday, June the 4th, Justin was scheduled to report for kitchen duty at Fort Lewis, but he never showed up. Since he had a good record, the dining facility decided to hold back on reporting Justin's absence to their superiors, as they hoped they could find him and deal with the situation internally. However, by Monday, June the 7th, Justin had still not turned up, so he was officially reported as absent without leave, aka AWOL. Well, it turned out that Justin had made an unexpected trip from Fort Lewis to Santa Clara on June the 4th, and surprised Yolanda by arriving at her apartment late that night. He remained there for the next several days, and would frequently leave to take what he described as important trips to Monterey. Yolanda also noticed that Justin was carrying the two guns he had recently purchased, and he had them on him at all times. When Yolanda learned that Justin's absence from Fort Lewis was not authorized, she advised him to phone his parents. Justin agreed to call them, and told his parents that he was not actually AWOL, but quote-unquote, working, though he refused to share any specific details about what he was doing. The Bergwinkles still advised Justin to contact Fort Lewis, so later that same night, he phoned his unit to let them know he would report back as soon as possible after he took care of a few things. However, Justin continued to remain at Yolanda's apartment, so she made an attempt to follow him on one of his clandestine trips to Monterey. Before they even exited the building, Justin saw Yolanda and a confrontation ensued, which led to her demanding an explanation about what he was doing. Justin's only response was for her to watch the movie White Sands, a thriller which had been released the previous year, and featured a story about a protagonist who becomes involved in the world of international arms smuggling. Justin had also mentioned White Sands during a previous conversation with his parents, and specifically said to pay attention to the character played by Mickey Rourke, an arms dealer who turns out to be a CIA agent. I'll be providing more details about White Sands later on in this episode, but at the time, Justin's reference to the film really didn't shed much light on what he was actually doing. On the morning of June the 12th, Justin left Yolanda's apartment at 10 a.m. and told her he would be back at around 4 p.m., but he never returned, and this would turn out to be the last confirmed sighting of him. Even though Justin had told his mother he would call her the following day in order to update her about the situation at Fort Lewis, he never did. According to his parents, when Justin failed to resurface, they tried contacting the police, the army, and even some U.S. senators in order to launch an official investigation and a search effort for Justin, but nothing was done, and no attempt was made to find him. Well, 3 months after he originally went missing, the Bergwinkles were informed that his abandoned Chevrolet Cavalier had been found in the parking lot of the Monterey Marina Bay Travel Lodge, an isolated beachfront motel located in Monterey near Fort Ord. Walter and Diane took a trip to Monterey in order to search the vehicle and found a briefcase in the trunk. It contained Justin's wallet, car keys, credit cards, some blank checks, his U.S. Armed Forces identification, and his military dog tags. The discovery of the dog tags was particularly concerning, as Justin had once had a conversation with Yolanda in which he told her that if his dog tags were ever found somewhere, that meant he was dead. The only personal items of Justin's that could not be found inside his car were the two handguns and ammunition he recently purchased. A check at the motel registry showed no record of Justin ever having stayed there, but the manager confirmed that the Cavalier had been parked there for nearly 3 months, as he assumed that it belonged to a guest who had left on a business trip and would return to pick it up at a later time. Unfortunately, no trace of Justin could be found in the area. Justin's loved ones started to wonder if he really had been working on some sort of secret clandestine operation which put his life at risk, but the army denied any knowledge or involvement in Justin's disappearance. The alternate explanation was that Justin had suffered some sort of mental breakdown and that he concocted an elaborate fantasy about a secret mission before he disappeared on his own accord. Justin's disappearance received very little media coverage at first, though it would finally attain national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1995. Sadly, the episode failed to bring about any solid leads, and in April of 2006, Justin's mother, Diane Bergwinkle, unexpectedly passed away at the age of 53, and her obituary listed Justin as having predeceased her. There have been no further developments in this story, so after nearly 30 years, Justin Bergwinkle continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Hi there, I would just like to take a few moments to give a shout-out to another podcast titled Wrongful Conviction. Hosted by celebrated criminal justice reform advocate and founding board member of the Innocence Project, Jason Flom, and by Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast host and producer Maggie Freeling, Wrongful Conviction features intimate conversations with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Each episode peels back the layers to tell the stories of those who have found themselves caught in a legal system gone wrong. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling airs each Monday, and Jason Flom's episodes air on Thursdays. Please search, find, and follow Wrongful Conviction wherever you listen to podcasts. So like I mentioned in the intro, there's very little information available about this case other than the Unsolved Mysteries segment and one article which was published in the Sacramento Bee in the months following Justin Bergwinkle's disappearance. However, if you search online discussions about this case, you'll find a lot of comments from people who claim to have known Justin personally and offer some interesting insight into his story, but I'll talk more about that momentarily. Over the years, Unsolved Mysteries produced a lot of segments about suspicious suicides and military conspiracies, and there's still a number of them that I have not yet featured on The Trail Went Cold because of one underlying problem. When I research these stories, I'll often find that there are very little or no outside sources besides the show. As much as I love Unsolved Mysteries, it's no secret that they sometimes had a tendency to distort the facts in order to further their narrative and add more mystery and intrigue to these stories. So when I'm unable to find many outside independent sources, I have to wonder if we're getting the full picture. We really don't know all that much about Justin Bergwinkle's service in the Army, as it's mostly based on secondhand information he supposedly shared with his parents and his girlfriend, Yolanda Antunes, who were interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment. The only other interviewee is a retired Army First Sergeant named James Tyler, who served with Justin, though it's not clear what kind of relationship they had, or if he was Justin's superior. But the segment does not feature official comments from anyone else affiliated with the military or law enforcement, which I find a bit unusual. I mean, it would be one thing if Justin had been killed, and his death was ruled to be a suicide, and the investigation was officially closed, but he was a missing person who went AWOL, and had still not been found. Was there anyone besides his family who was actually looking for him? It's interesting how in many of the Unsolved Mysteries segments about alleged military conspiracies, Robert Stack would often state that the military declined to participate in the broadcast, but he never actually said that for this segment. This has to make you wonder how much the show actually consulted with the Army while putting together this segment, or if they were basing most of their information on secondhand stories shared by Justin's friends and family. So now's a good time to address a number of comments which have been made about this case online by people who say they have a personal connection to Justin or his disappearance. One of the best resources is a lengthy thread about this case from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always referencing, and the thread dates all the way back to 2004. I'll add the obligatory disclaimer that I have no idea if any of these commenters are legitimate, but with so little hard information available, I thought they were worth mentioning. Most of these comments are from posters who claim to have gone to high school with Justin or served with him in the Army, and they describe him as a very likable, funny, and intelligent guy who did not give off any outward signs that he might have been suffering from some sort of mental illness that caused him to have delusional fantasies. However, one poster under the username Neon Noodle said that Justin would sometimes do daring things just to see if he could get away with it and avoid being caught. In fact, it's been theorized that this was the basis for the shoplifting incident, which got Justin drummed out of the Defense Language Institute, as he may have committed this completely senseless theft to challenge himself, but it wound up backfiring on him in a huge way when he got caught. I get the impression that Justin's attempts to become an Army Ranger were greatly exaggerated by Unsolved Mysteries, as he might have told his friends and family that this was his goal, but the shoplifting incident pretty much ensured that this was never going to happen. It sounds like Justin was reassigned to become a culinary specialist just so he could fulfill his remaining service obligations, but after 3 years of enlistment, he had still not yet risen above the rank of private. So it's definitely not unbelievable that Justin could have been fabricating all of his stories about secret missions in order to overcompensate for the fact that his military career didn't seem to be going anywhere. And I get the impression that Justin's friends and family initially thought he was exaggerating with these stories, but wound up taking them a lot more seriously when he turned up missing. Now, this aforementioned thread from the Unsolved Mysteries message board also contains a post from someone claiming to be Justin's little sister, Katie, who wrote, quote, "Justin, it's a total shot in the dark, but if you are out there, and by some twist of fate you find this, please know we love you and miss you very much," end quote. There are also a few comments from a poster claiming to be Justin's younger brother, Casey, who maintains that the family never saw any signs of mental instability in Justin as he was growing up. He also claims that when Justin went missing, the police wouldn't touch the case, and the Army did not communicate with the family or officially declare Justin to be a deserter, which is standard practice after someone has been AWOL for 30 days. However, I should mention that I've seen Diane Bergwinkle's obituary from 2006, and it says that the names of her surviving sons are Jeffrey and Jared, not Casey, and it does not list her as having a daughter named Katie at all. I mean, I guess it's possible that Casey could have been a nickname for one of Justin's brothers, but since this is the internet, I would take those comments which were made by Casey and Katie with a huge grain of salt. So I just wanted to make mention of a few more comments in that thread, which were made by a poster under the username MPIGuy, who said he was the lead investigator when Justin first went AWOL, and was unhappy that Unsolved Mysteries never bothered to seek any input or information from him. He believes that Justin was planning to rescue his girlfriend from a bad situation and bring her back to Fort Lewis with him, which is why he purchased the two handguns prior to his trip to California, but he wound up getting himself in too deep. However, MPI Guy acknowledges that this girlfriend in question might not have been Yolanda Antunes, but another girlfriend Justin might have secretly had, who lived in Seaside, California. Yolanda lived in Santa Clara, but Seaside is located 75 miles away in very close proximity to Monterey, so when Justin kept leaving Yolanda's apartment and all these secret trips to Monterey, could it have been related to a situation involving another woman? After all, Justin would have had ample opportunity to meet someone else while he was stationed at Fort Ord. Well, other than this guy's message board comments, I've never seen any information to corroborate this, but it is an intriguing theory. While it seems very unlikely that Justin was actually working on some sort of secret mission for the military or the government, perhaps he got himself mixed up in something he shouldn't have involving illegal activity, which put his life at risk. But the most prominent theory is that Justin suffered some sort of mental breakdown and may have killed himself shortly after abandoning his car, and his body has just never been found. So I think now would be a good time to compare Justin's story with another Unsolved Mysteries case I mentioned in this episode's intro, and that's the disappearance of Paul Wipke. Only a few years after enlisting in the Army, Wipke had reached the rank of First Lieutenant, and much like Justin, he was stationed at Fort Ord. But after driving away from the base in July of 1958, Wipke went AWOL and was eventually declared a deserter. Over a month after he went missing, Wipke's abandoned car was discovered nearly 500 miles away in a desolate remote section of Death Valley, and the Army believed that he suffered some sort of mental breakdown before he wandered out into the desert and died. However, Wipke's body was never found, and there was evidence to suggest that someone else abandoned his car at that location to stage his disappearance. Wipke's family believed that he may have been recruited by the CIA and sent on some sort of secret mission, and for security reasons, the government cannot reveal the truth about what happened to him. Well, I'm not going to say with 100% certainty that this was what actually took place, but I do find the scenario to be a lot more plausible in Paul Wipke's case than Justin Bergwinkle's. Prior to his disappearance, Wipke had a pretty distinguished career in the Army and was a decent candidate for an important secret mission, but by comparison, Justin Bergwinkle seemed like an average soldier at best. Like I mentioned earlier, he completely derailed his career with the shoplifting incident and had been reassigned to work as a cook, and while he was pretty skilled at language training, I don't get the impression that he possessed any other special skills which would have led to him being recruited for a clandestine operation. In fact, it sounds like Justin's work ethic seemed to suffer after he was kicked out of the Defense Language Institute, so I don't see the CIA or any other government agency gravitating towards this 21-year-old cook with no special skills or experience. Now, another parallel between Justin's case and Paul Wipke is that Wipke had also been displaying erratic behavior prior to his disappearance, but there's actually an explanation for that. The previous year, Wipke had been assigned to work on some nuclear weapons testing and was likely exposed to radioactive fallout, which caused great strain on his physical and mental health. So it's possible that Wipke really did wander off into the desert and die, but the Army still did a lot of shady things to cover up his disappearance to avoid admitting their own culpability in what happened to him. By comparison, I see no indication that the Army did anything to cover up Justin's disappearance, and it sounds like he vanished completely on his own accord. So there's another case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries around this time period, which also has similarities to this one, and that's the death of SPC Chad Langford, who was shot to death while performing his patrol as a military policeman at Alabama's Redstone Arsenal in March of 1992. I may cover this case on a future episode of The Trail Went Cold at some point, but long story short, even though the circumstances of how Langford's body was found were very strange, the military still ruled his death to be a suicide and concluded that he shot himself in such a fashion to make his death look like a homicide. However, Chad's loved ones believed that he was the victim of foul play because he had told them he was doing secret undercover work for the Army to investigate drug dealing. However, the Army denied that any undercover operations were taking place, so it's possible that Langford was fabricating these stories in order to make his family believe he was more important than he really was, and stage things to make it look like he was killed in the line of duty. Indeed, it is possible that Chad Langford and Justin Bergwinkle were both suffering from psychological problems and were secretly ashamed about their lack of progress in their careers, so they wanted to end their lives in a manner which made it look like they died heroic deaths. Of course, one of the key differences is that unlike Justin, I do not believe Chad had any serious disciplinary infractions on his record which would have harmed his career. And most importantly, Justin's body has never been found, so he still can't even be certain if he went through with the act of suicide. However, I definitely think there's a strong case to be made that Justin was having serious delusions of grandeur. I mean, I never served in the military or been assigned to do top secret work for them, but I have to think that if I was on a date with my girlfriend, I wouldn't just be casually mentioning, "Oh, by the way, I'm involved in some sort of secret mission, but I just can't tell you much more about it." I'm sure that someone who's trained in that sort of work would know to keep their mouth shut and not say anything like that at all in front of a civilian. The bit where Justin was carrying around this mysterious-looking briefcase in front of Yolanda and pulling out small pieces of paper to tear up really comes across as something that he did for show in order to make her think he was working on something important. When he asked Yolanda to turn around whenever he opened it, he was practically inviting her to take a quick peek. I have to assume that if you're working on an important top-secret operation and have a briefcase containing classified information, you're not going to take it to your girlfriend's apartment on a 2-week furlough. And if you did, then you are a really terrible operative and likely never would have made it past the screening process to begin with. Now, the most absurd part of the story is undoubtedly the phone call Yolanda received from the unidentified man who asked her to tell Justin, quote, "the mission's off." Once again, I've never worked on any covert secret missions for the military, but if your superiors need to get in touch with you, I seriously doubt that they're going to leave a message with your girlfriend that your mission has been canceled. But on the other hand, since Justin was out with friends when this incident took place, who actually made the phone call? Sure, Justin could have made the call himself in order to enhance this fantasy he was selling to Yolanda, but wouldn't she have recognized his voice? Well, interestingly enough, that aforementioned Sacramento Bee article from November of 1993 contained some comments from a soldier named John Aaron Barnett, who worked kitchen duty alongside Justin at Fort Ord. According to Barnett, there was one incident where Justin asked him to call Yolanda and tell her that Justin was on some sort of secret mission and was unable to see her. Barnett said that while Justin seemed serious when he made this request, he thought it was nothing more than a joke at the time. Now, it's not entirely clear to me if Barnett was referring to the mission's off call or an entirely different phone call Yolanda received at a different time, but either way, this shows that Justin had gotten other people to make phone calls to Yolanda on his behalf about secret missions. And since Justin was out with friends on the night Yolanda received the mission's off call, I find it totally plausible that he could have convinced one of his friends to phone her. Sure, no one has ever come forward to admit to doing this, but since Justin eventually went missing, the caller may have feared that they would end up under a cloud of suspicion and elected to stay silent. However, I suppose an alternate possibility is that if Justin was involved in something illegal, someone he was working with could have left that message, and the mission's off was some sort of code. After all, Yolanda said that Justin got really distressed when he returned to the apartment and she gave him the message, so if he orchestrated the phone call himself, it sounds like he was going all out to sell the whole situation. We also have to remember that Yolanda later found Justin sobbing in her apartment, so he was either really upset about something or suffering from some really serious mental health issues. So when Yolanda kept pressing Justin about what he was involved in, He told her to watch the movie White Sands, and since I have personally watched it, I'll share a few details about the film's plot. Willem Dafoe plays a deputy sheriff from a small town in New Mexico. He becomes embroiled in an intriguing mystery when a man carrying a briefcase containing $500,000 is found shot to death in the desert in an apparent suicide. A piece of paper containing a phone number is found inside the victim's stomach, so Dafoe decides to launch his own independent undercover operation in which he calls the number and impersonates the dead man, and after going to a prearranged meeting, the briefcase full of money is stolen from him. Dafoe soon learns that the victim was an undercover FBI agent, and he has stumbled upon a complicated operation involving an international arms dealer played by Mickey Rourke, who was planning to use the $500,000 to arm some freedom fighters in South America. It's eventually revealed that Rourke's character is actually a CIA agent who orchestrates the sale of weapons to America's enemies to ensure the survival of the military-industrial complex. White Sands originally came out in theaters in April of 1992, just over 1 year before Justin went missing, and in retrospect, it's kind of a weird choice for Justin to reference, since the film got mixed reviews and didn't make much of a dent at the box office. And quite frankly, if it wasn't for this case, most people probably would have forgotten this movie even existed. But the plot is based around a briefcase full of money, and Justin was often seen carrying a briefcase, so if he saw White Sands, maybe he was using it as an inspiration for an elaborate fantasy. Curiously, even though it involves the FBI and the CIA, the Army is not part of the film at all. But I think you could draw some parallels between Willem Dafoe's character and Justin. At the start of the film, Dafoe is pretty much bored with his life, as being a deputy sheriff in rural New Mexico is not providing him with much excitement, so this is why he takes the initiative to impersonate the dead FBI agent, and he soon finds himself weighing over his head. So perhaps Justin felt the same way about his own life, which is why he constructed a fantasy about becoming involved in a government operation. I know that Justin specifically told Yolanda and his parents to pay attention to Mickey Rourke's CIA agent slash arms dealer character, but I seriously doubt that the CIA is going to recruit a 21-year-old soldier with an average service record for a secret operation involving international arms dealing. All that being said, it's worth mentioning that there were a few reported incidents from this time period where military weapons from Fort Ord and Fort Lewis wound up in the hands of street gangs. In fact, in May of 1992, the newspapers reported that members of both the Crips and the Bloods, two rival gangs from Los Angeles, had arranged weapons for drug deals with personnel from Fort Ord, who would provide them with a surplus of hand grenades and handheld rocket launchers in exchange for drugs. Now, there's no evidence to indicate that Justin was involved in anything like this, but if these so-called secret missions Justin was referring to were not just paranoid delusions, maybe they were a cover for illegal activity, such as weapons or drugs or other stolen goods. One interesting detail from the Sacramento Bee article, which I previously did not know about, is that one of Justin's former army friends claimed that Justin often liked to flash around a military ID which had his photo on it, but someone else's name. These IDs were apparently quite difficult to counterfeit, and likely would have landed Justin in serious hot water if he was caught. So was there a reason he was carrying around something like that? While he was still stationed at Fort Ord, Yolanda said that Justin would sometimes abruptly end their dates and say that he needed to go back to Monterey, but he would do this completely out of the blue without receiving any phone calls or messages. And after he went AWOL from Fort Lewis, Justin spent a week at Yolanda's apartment, and on several occasions, he left on what he claimed were important trips to Monterey before he disappeared. I mean, for all we know, Justin could have just been staging the whole thing as part of his fantasy, but where exactly did he go when he left on all these trips? Did he just go off and do his own thing for several hours before he returned? Or could he have been involved in something else which had nothing to do with a secret mission? Well, I previously made mention of those comments from the Unsolved Mysteries message board by the poster known as MPI Guy, who said there were rumors that Justin might have had another girlfriend in the town of Seaside who had gotten herself involved in a bad situation he was trying to rescue her from. Again, it sounds like this was nothing more than rumor, and we have no idea if this other girlfriend ever existed, but since Seaside is near Monterey, that could provide an alternate explanation for all these trips. It's worth noting that Fort Ord officially closed in 1994, less than a year after Justin disappeared. But the original recommendation to close the base occurred years earlier, and the plan was to gradually transfer all the personnel to Fort Lewis, so Justin was not sent there because of issues with his service record or anything he might have done. So obviously, if Justin was involved in some sort of clandestine operation which required him to keep making trips to Monterey, why would the military transfer him to Washington in the first place rather than keeping him close to home? However, I'm sure the transfer was very inconvenient for Justin, since his relationship with Yolanda was getting more serious, and he was now being sent to another post located over 800 miles away. For all we know, this could have taken a toll on his already fragile mental health and made him even more unhappy with the state of his military career. Of course, if the rumors are true, and Justin really did have a second girlfriend in Seaside, then the transfer would have made things even more inconvenient for him and made him desperate enough to go AWOL to travel back to California. We still don't know where Justin went when he left Yolanda's apartment on all these secret trips, but we know that he made at least one trip to Monterey, since his abandoned car was found in the parking lot of the Monterey Marina Bay Travel Lodge. If Justin was the victim of foul play, I could see someone leaving his car there, but it seems odd that an outside party would go to the trouble of placing all of his personal items, including his wallet and dog tags, in Justin's briefcase inside the trunk. I really get the impression that Justin staged the scene and left the items there himself, particularly when you remember his previous conversation with Yolanda, where he said that if his dog tags were ever found, that would mean he was dead. Of course, the only items of Justin's that were missing were the handguns and ammunition he recently purchased, meaning that he may have gone off to a remote area and shot himself, and his body has never been found. But if he had always been planning suicide, you have to ask, why would he feel the need to buy two handguns and over 100 rounds of ammunition? It's also odd that he would purchase gun cleaning equipment alongside those items if the guns were only going to be used for the express purpose of killing himself. So I don't rule out the possibility that Justin legitimately bought those guns for the purpose of protecting himself, though whether it was protection against something real or imaginary is another matter. But even if Justin did end his own life, he didn't necessarily have to go to a remote area in order to do so. For all we know, his body was found at one point, but because he wasn't carrying identification, he was buried in a pauper's grave as a John Doe somewhere. Justin also happened to go missing right next to the Pacific Ocean, so if he drowned himself or jumped off a bridge into a body of water, that would also account for why his body has never resurfaced. Another option is that Justin did not kill himself, but decided to start over and live off the grid, which is why he left all of his identification and personal items behind in his car. For all we know, Justin could have lived for some period of time as a transient, but if so, the odds of him still being alive after 30 years are not great. Even though I believe there's no truth at all to the idea that Justin went missing as some sort of secret mission, I would not completely rule out the possibility that he got himself involved in something illegal, which put his life at risk and led to him being murdered. However, there's just no evidence of that, and until I see something more concrete, I'll continue to lean towards Justin being responsible for his own disappearance. I know that Justin was never officially diagnosed with any mental health issues, but you have to wonder if he might have started suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, as the onset of that illness generally starts affecting young males when they're in their late teens, early 20s. He may have legitimately believed that he was working a secret mission for the government and that his life was in danger, but things reached the point where he ultimately decided that suicide or disappearing off the grid were his only options. But until we find Justin's body, we'll never know for certain. What I find so frustrating is that I'm not sure if anyone is still actively investigating this case, or if they even were to begin with. Justin's family claimed that the police and the army wouldn't do anything to help them, and if you go to Justin's profile page at the Charlie Project, the investigating agency is listed as the Clinton Police Department. That's the Bergwinkles' original hometown, but I'm not sure how thoroughly a police department from Massachusetts will be investigating a missing persons case from California. It would be one thing if Justin's death had been ruled a suicide and the authorities had closed the investigation, but he is technically still a missing person, and even if he did kill himself, it would be nice to recover his remains and provide resolution for his family. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Justin Bergwinkle, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. It's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the 1970 murder of 18-year-old Joanne Weigel and the subsequent disappearance of her 18-year-old high school sweetheart, Mike Klein, who became a wanted fugitive before he could be arrested for the crime and has not been seen in over 50 years. In addition, I've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 murder of Philip Fraser. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Betty S., Emma G., Kiki, Ryan G., Kimberly T., Michael F., and Cheryl S. Thank you all so much for your support. I also wanted to mention that later this month, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes. In fact, at 9:15 a.m. on the morning of August the 28th, I'll be participating in a panel session with another podcast called Shockingly Wicked, in which we discuss unsolved mysteries. I'll even be screening a copy of my little scene video titled The Unsolved Mysteries Fanatic, which was made about 3 years before we launched The Trail Went Cold, and was our early attempt to turn this concept into a YouTube series before we ultimately turned it into a podcast. It features me doing my best Robert Stack impression, and not a lot of people have seen this video, but if you attend my session at the True Crime Podcast Festival, you'll get an exclusive screening. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which contains a very interesting thread about today's case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶